Hey, this is Dr. Joe Camerata with Golden Nuggets Podcast. I'm here with Dr. CJ DePalma and Dr. Mark Cardula. CJ, what's up, man?
Hey, what's going on? I can't help but smile every time I hear the name of this podcast. It gives me butterflies. Makes me happy.
We're really excited. We have one of our friends, Mark Cardula, here. He is going to talk to us about the physical therapy career and kind of what happens as you get out of school, start seeing people, and then realize that things might be a little bit different than you had originally thought, and wherever we kind of end up going with that conversation. So, Mark, happy to have you.
I am just feel privileged to be on the Golden Nuggets podcast. You know, it's I've seen you guys kind of bring this thing out recently, and I've got good respect for both you guys and what you do. So I'm looking forward to the conversation.
We are too. So CJ, you and I both have similar, I guess you kind of dove into this world a little bit earlier than I did, because you were in a clinical rotation and then worked at a clinic for like 3 months. And then you were like, F this, I'm out, and started the Movement Doctor, right?
Yeah. Yes. 3 weeks. And it might not even have been, cause it wasn't full time either. So, yeah. So I think my, me and you are for sure, me even more so, a little biased, like on like the direction of like how I viewed like the profession as a whole, and kind of like foreshadowing what I did and didn't want to do. And I was fortunate enough to be able to take the leap really, really early. But the majority of people that are shifting to the cash pay thing and getting from, you know, from traditional, like the traditional trajectory is just like becoming less and less common. Or at least it's becoming more and more daunting of a task to envision doing whatever these new grads are doing every day, 2000 hours a year for 35 years. Right. And so, you know, we wanted to have, Mark on, who is, who's been in the trenches much longer than we have, maybe not that much longer, just a little bit longer.
I mean,
and is in academia, and, me and him have been talking a lot over the last 6 months to a year about, you know, transitioning out. And so I wanted to kind of, pick his brain on why, and some of the reasonings of, you know, he's experiencing like the academia side, the pre-grad, right? And then, and the new grad, with getting a lot of interns and things like that. And obviously he puts out, some of the best content out there, evidence-driven. And so I think he'd be a really good person to chat about why this is happening, why it's driving him, maybe what we could do to potentially change it. And then, since we're all out of it now, not worry about it after we talk about it, and talk about like what the direction is and why, you know, like what his goal is with doing something on his own. Mark, can you give us your background a little bit?
Happy to do that. I am a little bit more seasoned as far as 18 years into my career. And I've kind of toiled in outpatient ortho pretty much for that 18 years. I've kind of dabbled a little bit in some side gigs with acute care to help pay down the loans and all that stuff. But it's been a kind of a journey of pretty much your typical. When I was in school, it was very much you know, heavy biomedical. I don't think I remember much about any biopsychosocial or kind of more rounded kind of education in my training. There was like a psych and disabilities class I faintly remember, but you know, when you're going through school, man, you want the sexy stuff, you want the manual therapy, you want the sports med stuff. I mean, that's where I think a lot of some of the biases, but we had a lot of folks too, neuro related, you know, colleagues and classmates and stuff. And then just kind of, as I've progressed in my career, I've been able to go through, you know, fellowship training, which has been great. I mean, there's definitely things I think are good and bad about it. I think the overall critical thinking, clinical reasoning, amazing, being founded strictly on defining yourself as a manual therapy, not as amazing. I think that's something as a profession we need to move past and move beyond, especially when science tells us that you ain't fixing people like cars, you're treating unique human beings. But that's probably for later parts of this conversation. And then I transitioned to Midwestern University here in Phoenix, Arizona. That's where I'm home based at. I had practiced in Michigan for a good period of my life, but moved down here and ended up at the Mayo Clinic for a period of time, and then had an opportunity to get into a clinical assistant professor position here at Midwestern University, where I'm basically in clinic seeing patients 95% of the time. And because that's where I really feel like the teaching I want to do takes place, as far as taking PowerPoints and bullet points and saying, well, how do I take that and put it in front of a, and apply it to a real breathing human being that doesn't always fit that nice little neat PowerPoint that, you know, you need to know for your board exams and stuff. And I mean, it's not obviously not important. It's just, man, it's just a scrape of the iceberg. And as you guys alluded to, you get out in that first, even your clinicals, and you start stepping out, especially independently on your own after you graduate. And then, you know, clinic just gives you a big kick in the gut of like, man, this doesn't work as black and white, or it's not nearly as black and white as it gets portrayed in my pathology class or in my kinesiology class or all these things that, and again, it's not that that's wrong. And we can definitely talk about where some of that stuff, probably necessary components of understanding the human pain experience, but man, woefully inefficient, doesn't prepare students to be good, prepares them to be safe when you come out into the clinic, but it's, something, if you want to be good and get to be a great therapist, you need to develop a process. And that's kind of, obviously, I know you guys do a bit of that. And that's what we do at Modern Pain Care, is try to create that for people, because it's just, you're not going to feel, I mean, if you come out of school and you feel like you got it figured out, that's somebody who's, I feel like, a dangerous PT who it's like either needs an ego check, slice of humble pie, or somebody who is probably not going to fit in our ecosystem well, because we're, you know, as you guys are, it's a lifelong learning process, man. Science isn't sitting still, it's changing. And I know you guys can probably relate to things you get taught in school, but a good chunk of it has been proven to be not the way the world works. As far as science tells us, it's not true. And then we're still teaching stuff. And I, right. I have to be held to CAPTI standards sometimes when I lecture and do things, which, you know, we can talk about that as well. That kind of holds programs to teach a curriculum that may not be caught up yet with science. So yeah, that's, I guess, a view of where I'm at.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting point of view as somebody who is currently teaching and has to stick to those guidelines. When I think about my time at Duquesne University out in Pittsburgh, we had a couple professors who I recognized their names on, you know, like APTA, like guidelines for treatment. And I'm just like, man, if you're sitting up on this like giant tower where you're able to communicate all this evidence-based information in a clinical practice guideline, but you don't seem to be updating with, you know, the BPS model or the things that we know now as far as trying to improve, then not to talk down on them. And of course, the clinical practice guidelines are supposed to be an amalgamation of everything that we have for a topic, but it's just kind of tough to get behind when we're looking back and they're probably doing the very same things that they went and did when we were going through school, you know?
Yeah. You know, and I think you got to step back and look at those clinical guidelines. You got to look at like academia, your job in academia, oftentimes, depending on your institution, if you're R level one, where you're really your job performance and your ability to maintain your track towards tenure is on publishing. You need to get involved in the APTA and these clinical practice guideline committees and stuff. But the unfortunate piece of that is often those folks aren't seeing many, if any, patients. You know, they're not seeing any humans with this stuff. So it's kind of maybe a weakness, because the folks that are on the front lines grinding, especially, you know, new grads who are getting grinded to smithereens with burnout and all that stuff. But it's just, they don't have time to maybe do this. Now there are some folks, I got some colleagues who are still, you know, doing clinical practice and contributing to those guidelines. I think that's great. And I think we need to involve clinicians. We need to involve patients into those guidelines too. We got some patient advocacy movements in GOSPT with like Julia Belton and some other folks that are kind of kicking us in the rear as far as not just having academics who aren't seeing patients. And again, I'm not saying it's wrong to have academics, you know, compiling knowledge and running studies and stuff, but I think we have to recognize that that's a, you know, missing, that's just a kind of a narrow kind of perspective that sometimes gets brought into and a biased perspective into research, which, and our clinical practice guidelines. I think we put these on, I mean, they're necessarily, we need them, and we need to have some sort of kind of thought process of like, you know, you can't just go out and do whatever the heck you want, but we also recognize that it's often a conglomeration of data by faulty human beings who might have a bias or may not be seeing patients and maybe not really consolidating it in a manner that's as clinically applicable. I mean, you look at some of the guidelines and different guidelines across professions and things for the very same condition, because they're taking a little different views and snippets of the literature that maybe fits their profession's worldview and things. It's you can see how human bias can kind of figure into that stuff.
Yeah, it's funny because when I've spoken with like clinical social workers that have been providers and friends before, they say that they have like this body that kind of regulates what it is they can and can't practice regarding how the evidence-based research kind of reflects that. And I think that that would probably be a really good thing to implement, because what you're kind of saying is that people can just really do whatever they want as long as the patient gets better. And the three of us know that there's a significant amount of factors that come into play out. Like even if we exclude everything that happens in the clinic, there's still a significant amount of factors that come into play to get people, you know, over that line. And so I think, there needs to be some sort of communication between the people who are seeing the patients. But then there's this problem of like, while you're seeing patients, you don't know really the stuff that we know now that we're a few years out. And now that we know the stuff we know, we're kind of making our way out so that we're not really affecting the career field anymore. Right. And so it seems this whole big broken loop.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough to navigate into the profession as a new grad these days. I mean, I can't even imagine like coming out with some of the, you know, saddled with the debt. And I feel at times I'm part of the issue because I work for a university and I'm part of the tuition fees that are being,
this is your fault,
straddled upon people. I feel dirty at times. I'm not going to lie to you. I don't like the fact that that's what we're doing to students at all. I just don't think that positions any human is, I mean, if our job market paid for what the debt load we're comfortably pays for that debt load that we're putting on students, then, you know, I guess I could be better. Okay. Or more okay with it, I guess, but yeah. And it's tough. And then you get out of school and you're seeing that, you know, this algorithm and kind of black and white way of working with people doesn't work as well as it's been portrayed. I'm not saying it doesn't work at times. There are definitely textbook cases that are out there, but I think they're fewer and farther between than we're led to believe in school. And it's a destabilizing experience, man. When you come out of school and you feel like you got it at least somewhat figured out. And then it's just like, there's days where you feel like I absolutely freaking suck. I have no idea what the heck's going on with half of these people. And what the hell do I do? And then, on top of that, you're going to see four of those people an hour and feel like a complete freaking failure and four times an hour. And it just, I can't even imagine getting into that situation and trying to, I honestly don't think I would have survived the profession. I had my moments where I was ready to quit. I just didn't feel like I was worth like crap as a PT just because I was trying to treat humans like cars and, you know, with the latest, mechanic skill that I was learning just wasn't cutting the mustard. It was, you know, I was, you know, sucking basically. So yeah, it's a tough game, man, to come out to a profession that's and I think that doesn't just exist in PT too, because I think, you know, biomedical education and stuff, I think we got to do better in education to round folks out. But it's tough.
Yeah. So I had some things I wanted to kind of chat before we shifted away. One of my like my biggest, I guess, quarrels of school and probably what drove me to do my own thing really, really early was the concept of like having a 200 PowerPoint slide on the thumb, right? That like legit, like there's just so much, right? There's all these directions, motion, all this thing. And then like the end of the slide would be like like you go through all these pathologies and pathophys and diagnostic measures and testing. And then it'd be like two slides on treatment. And I feel, you know, and I think you said it as soon as we started on this call, and you were like, you feel the most, you're like, you're mostly in the clinic teaching, right? And I think that's super important of like how to actually apply. But why do you think, like, if we're just talking specifically academia, why is it set up like that? Like, why is the, you know, does that set us up to be like ill, like more ill prepared to be a treating clinician as like this entry level DPT? Is it required because of the way the test is structured? I don't know. And I never understood it. And that's like what led me to come out really. I'm like, oh, okay. So we have this, like all these diagnostic procedures and measures for the shoulder for all these different pathologies. But then you look and it's like, it's a copy and pasted PowerPoint slide of how to treat seven different pathologies. And I'm like, well, then why do I need to know the ins and outs of all of that if I'm going to treat it the exact same way every single time based on like what their symptoms are?
Yeah, no, I think it's a big problem. I think, you know, we got, all these things about pathologies, kinesiologies, biomechanics, and all these things that supposedly should give us some like nice, clear black and white, this is the intervention I should. And then the interventions tend to be these canned basic things that aren't really individualized. They're very kind of standardized ways of looking at it. Yet there's so much variability we see in clinic, and there's so much of a supposedly similar, you know, tissue issue that, that kind of presents itself differently. I think a big problem is clinical reasoning just isn't taught. And I think there's a partly because it's hard to teach clinical reasoning when you're not seeing patients.
Sure.
When you're in a classroom, that's just something you need to have. And then clinical education, I mean, God love the CIs out there, but there's a conglomeration of what students are being told is the way to do it. You know, we got clinicians out there who are doing it diametrically opposite and foo-foo in this system. This system's better. The way I do it's better than yours and all this crap that, and if you look at the research on what system gets superior results, none of them. They all do pretty equally well as far as you get somebody who can navigate natural history, you come alongside anybody. Problem is, you know, we want to make it about our system and not about the human in front of us. But it's tough to, you know, really, you know, produce a situation in an undergraduate setting to really get folks to that clinical reasoning point to where they can see, okay, there's not an algorithm or a cookbook for a human being. There's, you know, there's some concepts and clinical reasoning and processes I have to say to, hey, I'm going to take that knowledge of what I learned in school, you know, the pathologies, the biomechanics, and see how it, and I have like a filter. And if it really, you know, Maitland used to call the semi-permeable brick wall, but it's a nice concept. It basically says all that stuff is theory till it fits the clinical scenario in front of you. And I think if you use that kind of filtering approach of, you know, and kind of that goes in a test retest and really staging a patient's symptom behavior and all that stuff that a lot of us are already in. But yeah, we don't teach students that, and they don't get it on their clinical rotations for some. Like some students get lucky and they get involved with somebody who's a very critical thinking, clinical reasoning therapist. But there are some therapists out there who are still rolling, you know, the ultrasounds and the tapes and scrapes and cups and needles without a lot of thoughtful practice behind it. I don't really have any issues with any of that stuff as long as there's a thinking brain behind it that's tailoring it to the person in front of them and not just tailoring it to what they do every day to that makes them have to think the least and just punch the clock and get in and out the quickest way possible.
The good part about our current, like the last 5 years or so, probably more like 3 or 4, is that there seems to be a whole host of groups, including Modern Pain Care, that are just like trying to and succeeding at affecting a large number of allied health providers in a way that can push this needle forward on a big way. I mean, you have you guys, you have Ben Cormack and Adam Meekins with the Better Clinician Project. You have Kalu now, the Level Up and Clinical Athlete together. There's so many things now that just didn't exist when, you know, CJ and I were probably graduating. Yeah, WOD prep, probably graduating when we were coming out. And so I do have at least a little bit more hope, as much as I really hate social media and the things that it does to me and the people that I love. I really think that if there was ever going to be like a big shift in the way that we catch people right as they get out of school or before they get out of school to alter that sooner, I think now is that time and it's exciting.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, traditional con ed too just doesn't fit the bill. It doesn't. You go on a weekend, you got some dude on stage or some, you know, I shouldn't say dude. There's plenty of women who are doing an amazing job teaching kinesi education as well. But, and it's this, you know, the subjects on stage, there's all this interaction effects, you know, of course somebody gets an improved thing because it's a million ways to make pain feel better, especially in a stage full of people where you're the subject, but probably another thing. But, and then you're on your own. You got two days with somebody and then it's, you're on your own, figure it out. And then you get the initial like, oh my God, this is the greatest. And then the reality of the clinic continues to stare you in the eye. If you look at it, that there's still people that ain't getting better. And it's not, then no matter which new shiny tool I throw at these people, it ain't, you know, they're not resting the hump of getting them back to the life they want to live or getting back to the gym or getting back to lifting their grandkids or stuff, because it isn't about your freaking tool. It's about being able to fit whatever you have in your box and not just searching for new tools. Learn how to use a toolbox, learn how to apply it to the human. And it's not just throwing passive stuff at people. It's really getting to know that human and the unique situation they're in and thoughts, beliefs, all that stuff, and then pushing them forward. But we still have this biomedical biased education where, man, it's all about you know, the pathologies. And I'm not saying that stuff isn't important. Like you guys with WOD prep, of course, you guys got to know mechanics and appropriate lifting formula. High load situations, you better believe movement matters and specificity of movement. But you know, we still got therapists out there rolling with the TA multifidus brace everything till you're, you know, you can't brace anymore. You're bracing when you're picking up a paperclip off the floor. I mean, come on. It gets to be a little bit ridiculous, but yeah, it's just a hard scenario for students to succeed. I think that's why we've created programs. And you mentioned some great ones with Ben and Adam, and Cal U's great. I mean, they're doing an amazing job with trying to push some knowledge forward. You guys are doing great at WAD prep and, you know, helping folks out as well. But it's just, you got to have somebody who's in your practice and having given you a process to start auditing yourself and checking your biases and recognizing that there's a process that you got to figure out what fits to that unique person in front of you. Cause you can spend time chasing 15 different courses with 15 different tools and get the initial honeymoon phase of that tool that you're feeling like everybody's getting better. And then reality will stare you in the face. I'm waiting for the tool that comes out that truly is special. In like, you know, and when we do systematic reviews and we see, you know, everybody pretty much follows the same course, regardless of what intervention you throw at it. That's a hard pill for ego driven therapists to swallow, but it's the truth that matters. So just let's freaking support people through their process of pain and get them back to life and not have to worry about being trademarked on some freaking tool that you wear on a polo shirt.
If you ask the MDT group, that is there, that's the tool. That's the second coming, the MDT, the McKenzie stuff. Yeah, I mean, I'm just talking shit here. So I have a kind of related question. And this can be at both of you guys. I don't know where the PT profession is going with coronavirus, because there is not a job that we had in the central South New Jersey area, at least for myself. And with the Medicare cuts coming through and with the clinics that probably shut down or continue to do so because of the current situation, as well as probably, I don't know if clinics are going to hire more PTAs or less now that there's changes in reimbursement. What do you think is going to happen to the PT career field?
I mean, I don't think we can continue to try to, you know, just scrap for the, you know, fight for the scraps of a biomedical system that is just woefully inefficient financially, completely backwards in how they, you know, front end people with expensive, invasive, non-effective interventions when it comes to a lot of the musculoskeletal stuff we see. And then, you know, eventually they trickle down to you where, you know, patients aren't wanting to. I mean, I think we have to be willing to step outside of that model of care and in non-insurance based ways. I mean, out-of-network stuff, I think, is a great way. And we have a freaking product to offer people. It's better research. I mean, that's not my biased opinion. There's plenty of research to say it will save you freaking money. It'll save a scalpel often being driven into your body where you get invasive stuff. You can't uncut yourself. Once that happens, it ain't going back. But there's just models where we have to just quit being, oh, please, physician, I just want another few referrals. I mean, I'm not saying that's not something we shouldn't maintain relationships with, but stop being like the, you know, the little baby that's just scrapping for, you know, the physician to feed them, and like be a freaking adult healthcare practitioner, own your degree, own the top of your license and freaking practice to it. And then put a message out to people where they can choose that versus a needle or an injection or a surgery. But I think we're still in this, we don't teach that to students. I mean, students have no idea how to run a business or how to put a marketing message in front of a human that would get them to choose you versus the other practitioner, the more invasive person down the road. I think that's a big issue we also have in our profession, is we don't teach people to learn how to, because you're selling people in the treatment room every day. 100%. Why don't you sell them on how to freaking to get in your clinic in the first place? Yep. To where then you can even sell them more on, I got this. I got you to where I'm going to get you better. I'm going to get you. Yep. I have no doubt I'll be able to partner with you on this journey. We'll get you back to, whether it's, you know, back to CrossFit or back to, you know, playing pickleball for our older,
man, I love me some pickleball.
See, I haven't got there, but I'll tell you, in Phoenix, man, it's the wave over in the retirement communities. So I'm probably going to do it just out of strict. I need to know what my patients are yeah, doing. I've seen it from afar, but not yeah, participated.
Yeah. I resonate so well with everything that you just said. And that's like one of the biggest conversations me and Joe have had, is like, is there a line from like creating their brand and selling? And I've said it from day one, like you are a salesman in the clinic regardless. And then there's people that fight against that. Like, you're not selling. You are, you're 100% selling every time, because if they don't buy into what you're saying, right. And I'm not saying you have to be gimmicky, right? You just have to get trust, right? And gaining trust is about selling. And so I think that's super important, and you're right. And it is one of the things, is probably the main thing that we're not taught. And so that's a big disservice. And so Joe, to hit on your question, it's very clear that like these cuts aren't going to stop, you know, and like they're going to keep coming. And so our loan to debt ratio, or our like debt to salary ratio, is just going to keep getting worse. I mean, it's like almost 2.5 times currently right now for your average, which is an insane amount for anyone who knows. Like, you're a good like graduate degree debt to salary ratio is like anywhere from 1-2 is pushing it. Most PTs are like well closer to the 3 mark, especially if they have undergrad loans. And so so that's a big problem, right? And so people come out and you're fighting an uphill battle already. So they feel the need to not be able to fight for what they want, right? And then, and so this is kind of going off topic, but I think that's like the issue with like the burnout, is because they take what's given to them right away because they feel like they need money, they need to pay off debt, because we have poor financial literacy coming as a doctorate profession, but most physicians do too. They just happen to make a lot more money. A lot of people who have gone to a lot of schooling have very poor financial literacy, and that's a huge problem, right? And I'm not saying the school needs to teach that, but like, you know, you're spending a lot of money, and you know, that's when we start getting into like federal issues of like just giving away a lot of money to a lot of people. But so I think that's where like the problem is. And so I've heard that to hit on what you said, Joe, about this reimbursement rates, is that I think based on what I've, you know, just kind of heard like in the vines, I'm pretty removing consistently from like most PT like social groups. Hold on, my dog is really,
dude. I love dude.
The noise cancellation on this must be amazing. I heard no snoring.
Oh, but, he was kicking, man.
I know Duke can saw him away.
He was kicking.
Good for you, Duke.
And so what my prediction is, based on what I've read, is that PTAs are going to get the axe almost completely as a profession, and PTs are going to get their cost of like our salaries are going to go down. They're, you know, because we're pumping out PTs. I mean, Florida alone has
creating a bubble.
Florida has 13 PT schools pumping out 40 to 60 students each school every 3 times a year. Like, blah, like it's crazy. And so there's an issue there, right? And so I think that that's where it seems like we're going to overload a profession with a higher degree, which the higher degree has had a lot of I think like kickback. But I think for us, it gives us the ability to have these new opportunities, right? And that's how I look at it. So like, yeah, we are a doctorate. Was it necessary to move the profession forward? No. Was it necessary to move the profession where we want it to go right now? 100%, because it has created the ability for us to have that autonomy. I think that answered your question. I think that sort of answered it a little bit. Oh, and coronavirus, go online, do telehealth. The training model, I don't want to talk about what we do, but it's the best way. It is the most, it has been looked at as like a very big risk, but the movement doctor and all of remote rehab offerings that were started prior to 2020 were fine. We were much better off, in a better position when this pandemic hit.
Just should have bought stock, man.
Should have bought it.
Yep.
Oh man.
No, you're right, man. Coronavirus has opened up some, like forced some of us into some markets and some kind of modes of delivery that have proven to be very successful. That's tough for a lot of folk who feel like the only juju is when the magical hands are being placed upon somebody. But I think it's definitely shown that that's a viable model, remote rehab and being able to, you know, partner with somebody, and it fits the lifestyle that most humans we interact with are. It's hard as hell sometimes to get people in the clinic twice a week. But if you can, people will pay for the convenience of having you in their pocket on the phone, on a message, on wherever they are at and they need you, they can kind of call upon you. I mean, obviously you have some formal sessions scheduled and stuff, but yeah, that's invaluable stuff. And I think, again, we need to position students to enter that market, but we're improving. I mean, I've had students join me on telehealth calls just when they've done some of the shadowing that they do in our university, but Yeah, I think it's an emerging thing that still isn't quite at a teaching regular level.
And now, is that the university that you teach at, or your Modern Pain Care University? I don't think that's a university, right?
Yeah, no, we're not a university of Modern Pain Care. We're just a continuing education, I guess, business, you could say, to trying to push the needle forward with things. But you know, at the university, we, you know, I was with our patient load. We have some patients, although not as much as of late, I think. But we get patients who will do the telehealth thing. So if I have students who are regularly shadowing, they can join me in on those consults to kind of see how it goes.
So tell us more about the Modern Pain Care, because it's really, I mean, like I said, I love all of this big name stuff. I, you know, full transparency, I don't subscribe to almost any of them because I just can't afford it, but I would love to get more information about that and have you tell people like what it is that you guys do. You and Jared, right?
Yeah. Jared Hall, is my partner, and we, and I created Modern Pain Care, gosh, I think it was like, 2015, somewhere in there. It's been a while, more than I've realized, but basically out of the frustrations that we talk about on this, as far as like, you know, the Con Ed isn't figure, you know, a weekend course just ain't cutting it. It ain't going to do it. And we still teach them, but we try to get folks into more of a lifelong learning process. And it can, you know, teaching folks to kind of level up a process, not just that's going to come out of two weekends. But we just actually recently started a coaching mentorship program where we're going to really put that model into action. It's going to be a continuous program that we have people coming in and out of. We're almost finished with our first enrollment right now, but basically we deep dive into people's practice, get them dialed in on a process, figure out where their holes are as far as where they feel they're having success in their practice. And, you know, structure a 3-month program to get them, you know, leveled up on whatever it is that they're struggling with. But we do that. We have a membership where we get, you know, experts from around the world coming in, do a masterclass. We just had Jared Powell from Australia, the shoulder physio, coming in and do one this last week, or this past week, Monday. We're fortunate. We've been able to get some relationships with some smart people. And we actually just partnered with a group that I can't say yet, but I will once I am given public word, but it gives us some great opportunities to kind of push the needle forward. And again, kind of help the process along to get, because our big mission is just, we got to do better and help people. And we can't just create robots therapists who think PowerPoints and bullet points are going to treat unique human beings. We need to do better. So that's arming people to be able to take that into practice and not just talk about it.
Which is really cool, because I always have this like idea floating around in my head is, if this whole like clinical treatment thing or, you know, online programming doesn't work, I could just create like a consultation business where I just go to a clinic and observe and tell them all the things that they're doing wrong, in my opinion, at least. And that sounds kind of like what you're doing. Like, you just have like your mentees sit in front of you, like, this is what I believe. And then you just go,
it sounds like. we try to resonate with their journey, man. Cause I mean, I can probably list a laundry list of stuff that, and I think we're making sure we enroll the right person. If somebody's like, dude, I wear this logo on my shirt and this is the only way to treat, and if I think otherwise, they're not going to be a good fit for us. We want people that are hungry to do better in our program. So yeah. And I think the best way to grow is to get some honest criticism. I think if you get people that are just pumping your tires, patting you on the back, you don't grow, you don't change, you just get more. And that's where I get frustrated, like the manual therapy profession. You know, there's not everybody, because there's some very critical thinking, thoughtful people, but it becomes like, let's roll to the latest AOMT meeting every year and pat each other on the back and get our dose of confirmation bias and not change any of the, push that needle forward in it. There are some definitely forward thinking people in there, but it's easy to fall into a career where you don't grow, and you just surround yourself in a world of confirmation bias that, in your view of it, you look like you're doing the best thing possible. In science's view and best practice view, it's passed you long since by.
Yep.
You got an opportunity to develop a process to stay on top of that, which is what we try to ingrain in people. Cause it's I've been in my share of the polo wearing, Kool-Aid drinking set of different processes and programs. So I'm trying to prevent folks from going down that same path that probably cost me about 5 to 6 years of productive career time, because I was so ingrained and treating humans like cars, like I said.
Yeah, I try and curate my physical therapy social media so that I am not just in a bubble. But the other side of that coin is that it makes me nuts when I look at some of the stuff that I see, and I just like, there's such a drive to just unfollow everything that doesn't, you know, scratch that itch for me. And I try not to do that because I know that as soon as that happens, exactly what you're saying is going to happen. But it is a much better way to take the people that are looking for further education or for that criticism, rather than trying to take those people who are not looking for it and spoon feed them whatever you think is your logical reasoning, because surely they have their own logical reasoning. They're not just pulling these ideas out of thin air, right?
Yeah. I mean, and it's okay to have your way of working with people. Maybe you've learned this technique or you're more of a Maitland, or, and I don't think we're pretty system agnostic as far as you can do whatever you want to some extent, I guess. You just got to have a thinking process to where you're validating it in front of the person in front of you. But completely agree with like social media. We purposely keep conflicting opinions in our feeds as much as it can be maddening, unless they're just jerks. You know, I don't really have time for folks that can't have a respectful dialogue with. I can't even imagine. I've seen the fitness athlete and powerlifting space on like Instagram and Facebook. I can't even imagine like what you guys, CJ, and I know you guys see more than just that space, but good God, some of this narratives that come out of there and things, it's maddening. But I think it's good to know we have folks like you. And I think hopefully folks look at us the same way of trying to put a more reasoned, thoughtful, science-based message out there to help people who are consuming this garbage on social media to have a little bit more of a nuanced person-centered view on things.
I think one of the really difficult aspects of trying to curate that information is that there's information on both sides. And so even if you stick to the research, right? If you can't recognize that this paper is writing from a biomedical like type view, or this paper is talking about core, but you know, there's this whole field of like core research that shows that it's no better than just regular exercise, you could still be with all this goodwill and blissfully ignorant, but it all depends on the context and the you know, learned responses, past experience of that person and their background too.
Yeah. I think you got to purposely have a process to like, you know, audit your practice and to continuously expose yourself to opposing views and viewpoints to check yourself, because it's easy. You're humans. We're biased. You know, it's what we do. We group together, we tribe up. That's just how we've survived over time. It's still how we attempt to survive even in these modern times, to where I'm not even touching the chat comment there, but there are definitely people who will assemble entire businesses around a very biased way of gathering research to support a viewpoint. And again, whether they're, you know, helpful in dialogue or have any opportunity to have a respectful dialogue, you know, and then again, you invest yourself in being a manual therapist or some sort of, you know, online entity that's the, you know, charging money. And we try to, we're not definitely, you know, immune from that. Jared and I are very purposefully saying we cannot become what we don't want, what we preach to not become. So hence why we try to keep our views diverse and make sure we're not walling ourselves into narrow ways of thinking. But it's easy to get people, and then once you get imbibed in it, man, and you get that whole, you know, you get invested in it to the point you just lash out when somebody, you know, criticizes your comfort zone or what you've invested your business upon, this model of thinking. You should never invest. If you invest on a model that's statically thinking this is the way the body or human works, your business model will die, because that's just, we're learning day by day, and it will get chiseled away to where there is no foundation and you're just, you know, selling a pack of lies. But, you know, some people have a hard time with that. They want to, you know, are more interested in selling than kind of moving things forward.
Yeah. CJ, are we strength therapists then? Or you're very variability therapist?
Functional therapist. which is where, that's like an actual thing, isn't it? Like in SNPs.
For real?
Functional. Yeah. Like they walk patients. Anyways. So I wanted to, I want to move the conversation forward, to talk about, what Mark is kind of doing and why, but I did want to hit, man, I just lost my train of thought. On what Mark was just saying about how like a certain way of thinking that's static will ruin the business. And I kind of want to counter and say that it might not. And that's probably more dangerous because of like the people that we see on the internet. They're very locked in their ways, but they create this guru and this like this deity mentality of like they're the best, right? So like there's the practices out there, like, so I saw someone who's like into L-DOA, which I had no idea what that was. I don't know if you guys have ever,
what is it, say it again?
L-DOA. It's like a breathing thing. It's like a posture breathing thing.
Nasal breathing?
I mean, like, no, it's really strange. And anyways, but I mean, she was like, well, I'm a level one something. But like, she was talking about some dude name, and it was like, his thing was like Grandmaster level four. And I was like, you can't be named Grandmaster level four of a clinician, like a healthcare thing. Right. And so I think that there's a more dangerous and more, or I guess, like, as far as like growing our profession, the staticness, yes, it will, that's what's going to hurt the profession. That's what is hurting it. But I think from a business standpoint, it almost ends up being something that's more viable, because you're so locked in and you become this crazy niche. And it's very unfortunate that it becomes almost like a, like, you know, I don't care about calling people out. Like, I've seen some PRI, like patients that have been like super deep into their reins, and like, they can speak the lingo, which I still can't speak to this day, of like whatever that they claim, and people just get stuck in there. And these treatment styles that are very much like expert driven and specialist and like levels, and you can see more advanced people, it pulls the patient in, man, and it just keeps them there for forever. And it, as a business model, it's fantastic. Yeah. And that's what's scary, right? Sure. And that's super nerve wracking.
If you live in that post hoc, you know, mentality where A plus B equals C, and this, like, was it a survivorship bias where everybody who rates me on Google says I'm great, you know, it's a,
and then you just go to all the grandmaster meetings every year and get your dose of confirmation bias to where, oh man, we're doing it right, everybody else is wrong. You can insulate yourself into a system and think it is the truth of the way it is, because you're not even seeing anything else and even considering anything else that might be going on in the situation. But that's a good point. I think it all comes down to your mission and your values and how you message what you're doing to the public. I think you can probably still do a bit of that with a good sound mission and values behind it, as opposed to, and some sound theory behind it, and just, you know, staying on cutting edge of treatment versus, you know, static blowing balloons around and stuff. And again, I'm not trained in PRI. I know enough and have seen enough of the discussions and science behind it to know it's kind of another one of folks getting invested in being a certain therapist, which I think, again, limits their growth and limits their ability to help patients.
100%.
Again, we can trumpet out, oh, well, this patient, the only thing they got better was this. You can do that with any freaking system. I'm tired of those stories coming out. Again, make it be out the patient, not your wonderful system. And if you wall them into one way of being able to find relief for pain and stuff, to me, you just narrow their ability to find, you know, a good movement in the world, if it's only through a balloon blow or some sort of needle being poked in the skin or stuff 100%. Like that. I think you're limiting your patient's ability to manage life.
Yep. Joe, were you going to reference this, or were you going to move conversation forward? Okay.
You good.
All right. So, so we've kind of tangented and haven't really discussed our general focus. So I kind of want to bring it back to Mark is making a general shift and he's starting to do his own thing. So I kind of want to talk like where you are with that. What are you doing? Kind of like what is it? And I really want to talk about why and why you're making the shift. So floor is yours.
Yes. You know, my shift is eventually modern pain care will be, you know, again, we will practice what we preach, and there'll be some clinical, you know, foundations to it where we're, you know, you're going to start seeing clinicians maybe, or seeing patients. And then that would be our classroom, having clinicians come in and see what we do and how we put into action what we bother them about doing as far as the process and person-centered care and that stuff. Right now I'm in the university setting and, you know, I have no complaints as far as it's a very good job, all that stuff, but it's just, I'm still in the belly of healthcare and it's frustrating. And, I'm the university part, the academics part, I think obviously love interacting with students and it's been great. I mean, there's good and bad things of anything. And I can't, you know, say anything bad about Midwestern. That's any different than some of the struggles that any, you know, academic setting has as far as translating current research to what hits them in the PowerPoint. But eventually going to be looking to do some more type models that bust out of this kind of healthcare system where you're scrapping for a neurosurgeon's after this patient's been through a dumpster fire of horrible messaging, horrible beliefs around their body, immobility, fear avoidance, the whole nine that oftentimes healthcare brings people in. I think we can step out of that and get on the front page of Google when somebody's searching their back, or on the front page of whatever, and get our messages out to people. I think there's a lot to be done. I've actually been purposely studying a lot of marketing sales. It's helped me in my clinical practice because I'm better at selling my plans of care to people and things, but it's also going to help me in business when I eventually put a shingle up and putting a founding site of Modern Pain Care's clinical practice out there, that we want to be affect the healthcare system. And it's not going to happen trying to work in the belly of the beast. We're trying to step outside it and create a different avenue for clinicians to not get burned out on 30 patients a day, to where they can freaking love coming to work each day. They got a learning environment that's going to push their growth constantly, and they're going to help people in a very non-nocebic, invasive, cost-effective way. And it's going to be probably outside of some of the in-network stuff that, you know, has our profession piling in, you know, 30 patients on a schedule and giving no individualized care and riding natural history, charging natural history because patients getting entertained for 10 to 20 minutes in a therapy setting. I guess it's better than in a neurosurgery clinic getting scalpel, you know, not that that doesn't occasionally have its place, but yeah, I think there's ways we can do better. And I think I'm tired of talking about it and being frustrated with it. I'm at the point where it's time to take action.
Hell yeah.
I love it.
Go CJ.
No, go ahead. I asked the question.
I don't really have a question, I guess. I more have like a thought.
Okay, let's hear it.
But I don't know if it has to do with Mark opening his Modern Pain Care business. Wait, here's a question. Is it going to be a brick and mortar spot, or are you just going to stay online with that?
I'd like to get eventually a brick and mortar thought. I'm actually in process of, I'm a member, although it's been on hold since coronavirus and things at CrossFit Blade here in Phoenix. I'll be kicking that back up in March 1st because they're probably, I mean, they're closest to me, but honestly, a great box. So I'm looking to start working a little bit with CrossFit athletes. I think there's this misnomer that, you know, some of the issues we see in just general ortho practice don't exist in the CrossFit population. There's some significant challenges there, but looking to start working, with the CrossFit box I've been in discussions with. Nothing's been agreed upon or anything like that, but I think there's just huge opportunity to kind of put that fitness facing kind of mode of healthcare instead of just like, wait until the wheels fall off the car. Can you start creating systems and settings where we start proactively keeping people healthy and out of doctor's offices, out of the pain physician's offices? I mean, granted, we're still going to have to work and help the people that are too far down that path of healthcare, maybe doing what it does. But I think there's different ways we can go about it versus just, again, scrapping for what biomedicine spits out the other side and get in front of biomedicine, use it when it's needed, because it's an absolute necessary part. The last thing I checked, PT doesn't help coronavirus or anything like that. I mean, maybe the side effects and stuff, but like we aren't going to change a virus. That takes biomedical skills to identify, develop vaccines, all that stuff. So it has its place. People oftentimes say, well, you think biomedicine's the devil. No, it just can be very limiting and disabling, especially when it comes to musculoskeletal conditions. So we need to do better. And I think, again, stop talking about it, start doing things about it.
Shout out to your snatch PR, by the way. Really great.
Yeah, dude, it was ugly. I'm staring at the floor. I'm all rounded. My butt comes up early. I mean, I pretty much, I like the WOD prep group. I get in there, oftentimes lurk, but I like getting, it's good community there. I mean, that's been one of the best things that's got me through coronavirus, as far as, and my wife being so nice to allow me to spend some money on our garage gym. Hoping that'll be part of Modern Pain Care's initial brick and mortar spot. So there's that investment was
targeted. Yeah, I'm glad you were able to find some weights. I remember sending you a link to some 100-pound plates, and you were like, yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, shortly after, I was on the fence of like, should I pull the trigger on those? And then all of a sudden, rogue, I was on like every list of alerts when products became available. And like, I remember I would be like walking with my wife and kid, and then bumper plates would come available. I get the alert on my phone. I'm like, stop. And I had to freaking like jump and get the credit card out. So pay for it, because those things lasted for like literally 10 minutes and then they were already sold out again. So still that way for some things. If you guys have some change plates, I'm looking for 2.5s and 5s. If you can help a guy out, I'll even
one, pay for 2.5, I could send you.
If you find
That's not helpful.
If you follow as many reviews as possible on Instagram, it's this guy, all he does is do reviews and just turn your notifications on. He gets the first note, like Rogue legit contacts him when, or at least it seems like that. I don't know how he gets it so fast, but he'll basically make a post and it'll be like iron plates available. And so you'll get it. That's how I got all my stuff during that time, which was only like a bike.
So let's go back to talking about the brick and mortar thing, because I know that there, that the three of us, or at least CJ and myself, are like really biased towards exercise, right? But, you know, we know that with recent stuff that's come out that exercise modes as a general don't, like, it doesn't really matter what it is that you do. And I know that Ben Cormack kind of hits on this a lot. It's like, it doesn't matter what you do as long as you do some sort of value-based sort of exercise. But I think that we can at least attest to the type of exercise that CJ and I prescribe or give to our lifters is that it's a moderate to high intensity and has this secondary effect that is listed by, like, you know, the the activity guidelines for all Americans, right? You need to do this stuff to be healthy. And I at least sleep soundly at night knowing that even if the stuff that we give out to our people to try and help them while they're following that natural history, they're at least getting healthier if there is no, you know, sort of efficacious side effect from that stuff.
Yeah, no, I think we just had Jared Paul, like I said, this past Monday, talk about how really strengthening for shoulder pain. We don't really have any good evidence that pain and disability gets better, but it's hard to argue. I agree. Like, the secondary health benefits of exercising from a metabolic, cardiovascular, I mean, you're not going to get that from a needle being poked in you or somebody jumping on you for a whack and crack on your neck or back. I mean, it's not to say those things can't help pain, but again, they haven't shown any real efficacy. I think exercise probably the best choice as far as when you think about those secondary health benefits. Does it confer special superior benefits from a pain and disability? I don't think we have a ton of data to support that. But again, I think in the CrossFit population, you got a lot of folks where valued living is involved in exercise and loading their bodies and participating in CrossFit. So getting that, especially that population and the powerlifting population and folks that are just trying to get well, I think especially right now in coronavirus, we're seeing that, you know, a good healthy immune system has a protective role. Exercise can definitely build you up. And I think right now we have a unique opportunity in PT. If we can capitalize on that message, like, we are probably the best positioned profession if we just put away freaking shiny tools and get to the basics of being good prescribers of exercise, which again, we're not maybe as good at. We need to improve our strength and conditioning components and all that stuff, but create healthy humans. And if manual therapy needs to get somewhere where they can start engaging in a healthy lifestyle, then great. And if a needle needs to be there, fine. If a cup, good. But it shouldn't be the freaking center stage,
right?
So of how people get well.
So you kind of follow like kind of what PT Inquest or Eric Maris says, where it's, I don't care what it is that you're doing. I care what it's you're not doing, which is like all of that stuff that, you know, would be the main, like the meat of the potatoes of the treatment world.
Yeah. I mean, I used to be somebody who, I've been a vocal critic of needling. I don't honestly care. Honestly, if people want to get needle certified or cup certified or tape certified, go to it. But again, if you're thinking that confers some unique superior benefits, yes. If you go talk to people on Facebook and Instagram and go to the monthly or yearly conference that pumps you full of that bias, you're going to believe that. I would too. And I've been that person with certain parts of my intervention development and treatments I've learned over time, but we need to look past that stuff, man. If we're going to compete in the healthcare space and have a message, cause I think we have the data on getting people, you know, lifestyle and getting well human beings and being more upstream in healthcare versus the downstream dumping grounds that we get sent to us often from biomedicine. I think we jump on that, man. And I think don't worry about the freaking physician being happy about it. Make the person happy. They'll be not in the physicians. The physicians will take notice if we do what we can do and stop trying to like beg for their, you know, scraps of a referral here. And I'm not saying we can't still work that if you have those relationships, but man, it's just, I think we limit ourselves by being kind of stuck under that system.
Yeah, I agree. I think the one thing that I would never say that my like in-person practice was like a raging success, but we were comfortable and we did well. And And I would never consider myself a great clinician from like the normal standards of like the things we talk about in school. But what I did well was communicate with people and like create a relationship and the soft skills. And like talked about earlier, like this sales concept. And so, you know, people come in and we just have this like relationship with us in the private practice or the cash pay, whatever you want to call it. You know, the ability to have one-on-one care has like given me that opportunity as a clinician to really hone in and focus on that more, right? To like elaborate and like not elaborate, to elongate and really dive into the educational process there. And we've set ourselves up as a profession to not be able to effectively do that, right? To try and educate someone on like even just like rudimentary concepts of pain in 10 minutes during an eval when they're trying to subjectively give you their story and you're trying to give them feedback on it. I think we've really just created a big problem there. And some people do well, like, and then we have this like other, probably a problem with, you know, post-hoc issues of like, you know, oh, well, I see three people, my outcome rates are really good. And it's like, I mean, are your outcome rates really good or just people getting better, right? It's like so there's so many issues there and that's okay, right? And that's totally fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But again, it creates this biasness that like what you're doing is really good. It's just so tough. And so some people are in this traditional model and they feel very successful and they probably are if you're looking at numbers. And so I don't want to knock that. I think one-on-one's the only way to see them. But for me, it was the only way I felt I was going to be effective as a clinician. And I think that's a lot of people moving to the one-on-one or to the one-on-one model. I hope that's their goal, right? You know, it's, you know, obviously you can be being your own boss, like, you know, you have like financial opportunity there, but you know, I think it really does give you an opportunity to like communicate and be a person with the person in front of you.
Yeah. If you look at the trends that you guys talked about already with healthcare reimbursement and stuff, businesses aren't going to be staying afloat unless they divide you up more to where you're seeing more people at once. It is the way it is. And if you want to keep it on that path, I mean, I just don't see how it's sustainable from a just sanity standpoint to be able to see so many patients. Now, there are probably clinicians, and I know there's clinicians who can see people, you know, double booked. And I think there's some reasonable times where that can be done well. There's probably some strength to some group settings where you got people who are kind of pushing each other along and different things. But I'm with you, man. I think if you want to provide the best top of our license, best care to really tailor to a human, I think one-on-one's the best place to provide that. And I think it's becoming increasingly hard, and not to say there are settings out there that do it. I mean, that would be my big thing. If I'm looking to come out of school and find my setting, that would be the number one thing. I mean, mentorship and stuff gets, you know, bandied around and then you like cut your salary and then the mentorship ends up being like a, you know, half-ass here or there confirmation bias fest. That's not necessarily, you know, up in your game as a clinician. I'm not saying that's all, because there's some clinics that do it great, but yeah, I think, you know, there's opportunities for PTs, but you just gotta find settings that you know, allow you to grow the way that and give you the opportunity to form those relationships that you talked about.
Now, Mark, is Modern Pain Care on TikTok?
We're not on TikTok. You know, I've dabbled. I think I've got a TikTok account, dude. I am just not. I'm still trying to figure the platform out. It's been a while since I've been on there, but. You know, we definitely are sensitive to the fact of where our audience is, and Instagram definitely seems to be where folks are at. I am not one to be out there shaking and dancing on social media too much. My wife already is appalled by, you know, if I have too many beverages at weddings, I let loose, be ugly, but it's all good. But we'll check it out. Maybe, who knows? Maybe we'll have a TikTok page before you know it.
Now, what are your thoughts on clinicians who are on TikTok or on Reels on Instagram, their ability to communicate complex topics in a very short period of time? Cause that's been something that's been chapping my buns quite a lot lately.
Yeah. I think, you know, the headline based stuff, that's a clickbait worthy, that has, you know, minimal, you know, foundings in any reality of the world. I struggle with that. I think there's ways you can be thoughtful and still do that, because I think we also have to be sensitive to the fact that that is the world we're living in media wise. And if you want to get your messages out to the consumer, you can be as mad about it and as grumpy about marketing and sales, and then just don't, you know, I've been that person too. Then then don't bitch when people don't come to your door. You're not putting your message out there to bring people to your door. They're not going to, like, you know, I mean, I guess you can put blog posts out there and stuff, but we live in a world where if you want to get your message in front of people and do the upstream approach and get one-on-one and build your own practice, then you need to be able to put your message out there and compete with the garbage that's out there and in social media worlds, even if it's painful. And I'm with you, Joe. I'm not a huge fan of social media. I only do it strictly from how do we move our mission at Modern Pain Care forward. I could care, and I like dogs and puppies and seeing people's kids do cool stuff. You know, obviously I could definitely do it without the politics and all that other crud with it, but
we almost made it. We almost made it almost. A whole conversation to not even use the word. It was so close. All right, continue.
Well, I'm looking forward to watching you, like, you know, point
here,
to the,
you'll hear. I always like CJ's post, like when he's in the gym doing the,
the old
electro techno beats going in the background. I mean,
Dad bod playlist.
That's it. I'm taking pointers, and you know, I'm gonna see if I can have CJ. Maybe he'll sell me his playlist. He could probably make some money on the CJ jams or something like that.
I do have one more question. When can we expect the next Clinical Thinker podcast episode to come out? Because I subscribed, and I'm left hanging here, man. I'm looking for episode 12. What's going on?
You know, that unfortunately that podcast was dissolved. I enjoyed it. It was just tough logistically with Ben, Jared, and myself to get on, all three of us. I'm sure you guys can relate to it, just trying to get you guys on a podcast together and us three on it. But yeah, I had a great time. I always enjoy Ben's perspective. I've learned a great deal from Ben Cormack and all he's doing with his own Core Kinetic, you know, brand, and what else he's doing at Better Clinician Product Project with Adam Meekins. So, you know,
but now you have the Modern Pain Care podcast, right?
Yes, we have the Modern Pain podcast. I don't know if we'll be, you know, hit the levels of the Golden Nuggets, but you know, we ascribe we don't have the brand appeal, and the name just, you know, obviously crushes it with the picture. I always also enjoyed it. It's you guys are on a good footing. How many podcasts are you guys in, by the way? How many is this?
This is number four.
I'm just, you know, top 10.
Yeah, you're bottom floor level, man.
But yeah, no, I think we're trying to hit the appropriate channels to push our message out there and get in the world of people to where we can start, you know, getting in their practices and helping them, whether it's through a membership, through our online course, or through our deep dive, you know, coaching mentorship stuff where we, you know, kick you in the brain hard and get you thinking and moving your profession and your community forward of patients. That's what we're after. So.
Can I just tell you that when I listened to the Clinical Thinker podcast, what was it, 2 years ago now? I thought you were the British one. No joke.
I've had a few other people think the same thing, like that I was the Brit. Maybe I have a British look. I mean, I always tell people I have a face for podcasts, so I don't know why the Brit thing gets confused, but it's, you're not the first person.
And then I remember commenting on one of Ben's videos. I was like, oh shit, you're the one. He's like, what are you talking about? I was like, nothing.
Yeah, you hear the voices. I've had that before too, but you hear somebody's voice and what you picture them to look like is completely opposite of what they end up looking like.
Any chance we could hear your best British accent on the pod or no?
I don't want to drop your ratings right out of the gate. I mean, this is only
they're really high.
Let's keep the trajectory heading up and up.
True.
I'm definitely going to be sharing this episode to our followers and listeners too, so they can
Legion of Change
be firmly right? indoctrinated by the world of Mark Cardlet. No. Again, hopefully they see that we have a pretty nuanced, open approach to focusing on the person, not on strictly, you know, your brand identity and stuff like that. Of course, those need to exist, but if it's all aligned with pushing best practice forward, we're game.
CJ, you got any other things you want to talk about?
Yeah, well, not really. It was more of like question of the day kind of thing. Just like end on something light. Joe, you come up with some really good questions sometimes. Nothing end of the world related or politics related. Ready?
Did you listen to the last podcast?
No, I haven't.
Because I asked about the end of the world.
Okay. We can't do that on the episode. No. All right. Something less turmoil.
Have you ever owned or will you own some chickens in your lawn yard?
You know, our, in Phoenix, man, the yards are like at a premium. Like it's hard to find like any significant square footage or square, you know, acreage. But although you can, it's just, you got to pay like 750 grand to make that happen. But I actually do know some people like at our CrossFit box, we've got somebody who brings in like, you know, eggs every once in a while from the chickens they raise. So it's not uncommon. I think, you know, if the end of times come, as I know you're mindful of, I think it'll be good to have your own ability to produce eggs and such survival assisting foods. Yeah. Yeah. And nicely worked. And I don't know if you guys are like digging the old bunkers in the backyard yet, but you know, it's good to be prepared. If chickens are part of it, I think that's, you know, props to you boys.
Well, we're not going to advertise what we are or are not going to do for the end of the world, because then everybody's going to want to join in. But
that's right.
You don't want anybody to come into your end of the world survival camp. No, I hear
I don't
you.
Have that much, or won't have that much food for them, you know. Cool.
Yeah, I'm actually taking a financial planning class, and it's kind of talking about doing some preparatory stuff with food and water and stuff in case the, you know, things get off the rails in the world. And, you know, who knows? I would have never considered it maybe a few years back, but as things have transpired in the world over the last few years, I'm considering that a lot more seriously than I have, for sure.
Who knows? Today's inauguration day. There might be a big pivot.
Stop.
All right, cool. Mark, where can the people find you?
Well, you can find MCargula DPT is my handle on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. If you want, Modern Pain Care is the handle on Facebook and Instagram as well. Modernpaincare.com is our website. Checking out. We just actually launched our website onto a new platform, which is going to give us a lot more opportunities to produce some higher quality content. And we have a membership and all that stuff too. But people can check that out, modernpaincare.com/courses, if you want to see what we're up to and see if you guys can, if there's a good fit for where folks are looking to move their careers and what they're up to.
Hopefully they'll have a CrossFit course someday.
Yeah. Well, you know, we were in discussions with a few gentlemen who I'll leave unnamed, as far as maybe seeing if we can collaborate on such activities to see if we can, because apparently CrossFit people have pain too, and they have thoughts and feelings and beliefs around their pain, often probably in sometimes a little bit more off the beaten path than some of our other folks who we automatically think, oh, it's chronic pain, so you're only seeing persistent painters. I'd say that I deal with a lot of this stuff with my athletic populations as well. So, yeah, be on the lookout. You never know what happens down the future as far as what offerings we have.
Very cool. Well, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate the time, especially the short notice scheduling. That's the beauty of not being in the clinic 24/7.
Yeah, no, it's always a good pleasure to chat with you, gentlemen. I mean, obviously, I get a good dose of confirmation bias with you guys, but I hope that, you know, we see that we actually think that we might be living in a world of confirmation bias and seek to, you know, remedy that as much as we can by keeping our minds open with other views. So great time today.
Yes. Cool. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. CJ, anything to the people?
Nope. Thanks for joining the Golden Nuggets podcast.
See you guys next time.